Today's episode comes not from Silicon Valley, but from the Philippines. Population? 110 million. The capital? Manila. Official languages? Filipino and English. Top exports? Electronics, furniture, coconuts, and pineapple. And fun fact, the Philippines is known as both the social media and texting capitals of the world, with 80% of the population using social media actively, and Filipinos sending over 400 million text messages per day. The BRICS. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. For much of the 2010s, if you were to ask any global investor or geopolitical pundit what the hottest emerging markets were, and they'd likely point to one of those BRICS nations. More recently, countries with these really big young populations like Egypt, like Nigeria, like Bangladesh, and like Vietnam, well, they've caught investors' fancies as well. But there is one booming archipelago nation of over 7,000 islands in Southeast Asia that likely deserves a whole lot more attention than what it gets today. The Philippines. The Philippines has a population of over 110 million, with a median age less than 26. And whilst the Philippines has over 110 million people living there, consider the fact that there are 12 million Filipinos living outside the Philippines, like in the US, in Canada, Japan, Australia, and really everywhere in between. And finally, amongst the more than 110 million folks that live in the Philippines, a vast majority speaks English, making the Philippines the third biggest English-speaking country on the planet. Now, combine these staggering statistics with the facts that, A, there's billions being spent to lay 4G infrastructure throughout the country, B, there's been an influx of really affordable smartphones flooding the Filipino market, and C, you have a digitally native country that's been called the social media, the texting, and the selfie capitals of the world, and, well, you have the perfect storm for an imminent Filipino tech boom. And for Roland Ross and live streaming social media app Kumu, it's been boom indeed. Starting in 2018, Kumu has taken on the name the Disneyland of social media, allowing content creators to live stream what it is they do best, from shooting hoops to singing to just hanging out with their communities. And with viewers rewarding creators with micro gifts, think flipping the guitar playing street performer a buck, Kumu has become the highest grossing app in the Philippines with over 10 million users, raising over $100 million in the process and well on its way, no matter who you speak to becoming a Filipino unicorn. But to get here, seemingly overnight, for Kumu founder and Filipino-American Roland Ross, it's been a far longer, far harder journey. One of travel, of introspection, of failure, and of a newfound love for his homeland, the Philippines. I'm David Zabinski.
And I'm Roland Ross.
And this is Not From Silicon Valley. Roland, welcome to the show, man. So first things first, tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
Yeah, so basically, I was actually born and raised in Los Angeles. My mom raised me. And, you know, being Filipino-American, I was always curious about the Filipino side of my identity because growing up in Los Angeles, the only thing I knew about my Filipino side was through the Filipino food that she cooked. And when I had an opportunity to study at the University of California, Santa Barbara, there was a study abroad program, and one of the countries picked were the Philippines. And I studied at the University of Philippines, Los Baños. And when I studied out there, I was in the countryside, I was in the mountain. And while I was out there, I just knew in my heart that I felt more at home in the Philippines than I did back home in Los Angeles.
All right. So what was it about growing up in LA before studying in the Philippines that was so, I don't know, so void of Filipino culture? Were there no other Filipino Americans in your neighborhood? I mean, what was growing up like?
So I grew up in the Valley. And so while I was out there, when my parents split and my mom raised me, we actually moved an hour out from the Valley during my formative years when I was in middle school, high school, which is a place called Palmdale. The neighborhood was primarily minority because it was a desert. It was like, how would you say, like, it kind of reminds me of like Breaking Bad. It was just like kind of basically poor. You know, I was, my mom, we really couldn't afford to live in a house. by ourselves. So I was actually living underneath the stairs. Me and my brother joked, it was almost kind of like that Harry Potter type of feeling where we were living underneath the stairs. We had like these sleeping bags. He had a purple sleeping bag. I had a blue sleeping bag. And then we would roll them up and then put them in the garage every day before we went to school. And it was actually there. It was really interesting because growing up, my dad was a Harvard educated heart surgeon. And so we were actually born into, quite a bit of resources, but, you know, just personal circumstances between my father and my mom, put us in a situation where my mom just wanted to raise us without too much of that influence. And yeah, it was, that's crazy. Yeah. So yeah, looking back, it was really cool because, you know, you have this situation where you are growing up from birth to say around 10 or 11 years old, where there's a lot of wealth, to all of a sudden, you know, living in a situation where me and my brother discovered hip hop culture. I was really into DJing, scratching records and stuff like that. My brother was into breakdancing to get away from gang culture and violence and stuff like that, and really allowed me to, understand a completely other side of society. And in a way, I think I'm just super blessed having both of those perspectives, because it just really allowed me to really relate to a lot of people, whether you were born in a silver spoon in your mouth or, you know, someone who was a bit urban and talked a lot of crap. So, yeah.
Man, it sounds like a very difficult upbringing. I mean, your mother, to raise you and your brother alone as a single mother, did she work? How'd she sustain herself and her boys?
So the main job that she found was an office job where she was doing transcription, medical transcription, stuff like that. And so she would actually have to commute really long distances to Los Angeles to do that. And so she would be really tired. And that was actually a really interesting situation, because she was so tired that she would actually stay at her boyfriend's house at the time. So for a lot of the times, me and my brother were actually during the weekdays, we were kind of raising ourselves during high school. And I think for us, it was really formative because it just forced us to mature a lot. You know, I saved up for turntables and had the turntables in the kitchen. My brother, we would get the linoleum from Home Depot and, you know, practice breakdancing in the living room. And, there's always this joke. My mom, as hard as she worked, she said that she overheard us with our friends, because we only had basically a card table in the living room and fold up chairs, and that was it. And then our beds were on the floor. And my mom said that she overheard us saying to our friends, like, "Oh, my mom says that we're minimalist, but we're actually poor." And she thought that was the funniest thing.
And what, that you went to, was it UC Santa Barbara for college?
Yeah, so I went to the Santa Barbara campus. So UC Santa Barbara has a rap for being a party school. One thing that I loved about Santa Barbara was it was one of those places where I was able to really fully flex my presence on campus. It's not as big as like a UC Berkeley or a UCLA. It was beautiful. I mean, it's right on the beach. And the academics, when you look into it, were really, really good in terms of engineering, physics. We had just won several Nobel Prizes in mathematics. I think it was one was in mathematics, or sorry, economics, physics, and chemistry. My context, though, was I was politicized over there and quickly became a student activist and got into anti-globalization activities and student protests and stuff. So it's kind of funny.
Okay, so fast forward a year or two, study abroad. You know, most 20-year-olds do Rome, Barcelona, London, Sydney, Shanghai, whatever. But you chose the Philippines?
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. I mean, so that's what really stood out to me. I've been so curious about the Filipino side of my identity that I saw as one of the options the Philippines, and none of my classmates wanted to go. They were just like, "No, we are exactly what you said. We're going to Rome, Barcelona, Tokyo, even Seoul." And I ended up being the only classmate who decided to go to the Philippines. And when I went there, I just fell in love. I just, there's just something about that place.
You know, man, I really want to hear about your experience. I've never been, but I've got so many Filipino colleagues, Filipino friends. I've been dying to go for years. So now I'm thinking about in your shoes, right? You're this Filipino American, your mother's Filipina naturally, and you've never been to the Philippines. The first time you're what, 20 years old, you land in Manila, and then what?
So like the first thing I remember was just that tropical smell of just like, what the heck? And then the noises. I've never heard so much honking in my entire life. It was so overwhelmingly, it was funny because I remember there was a moment where I just stood there and smiled and just absorbed the sounds of so much honking. And, and that was just in Manila. And, once we went through our orientation and we got shipped out to the province, UP Los Baños is like an agricultural campus. So call it more like a UC Davis, if you will. And we're on top of a mountain, we're in the countryside and really so much green, just greenery everywhere. And being able to listen to the context of what it meant to be Filipino and American. So one of the cool things about working with the University of the Philippines, it was actually based off of and got a lot of influence from the University of California, is the public school teaching, where we did get the context of, the impact of globalization, the impact of the U.S. relationship with the Philippines. So we went to places like the former Air Force base and naval base of the U.S. in the Philippines, and the sex trafficking that occurred, the toxic waste contamination that was left behind, the fact that, a lot of the natural resources like mining and things like that were given to, multinational corporations and stuff like that. So in a way, it was a very, a very drastic way to really come face to face with that hyphen of being Filipino and American, and seeing exactly what that relationship between the Philippines and America was by going through this program.
So I unfortunately never learned about Filipino-U.S. relations growing up in school. You mentioned what, U.S. military bases, sex trafficking, a toxic wasteland. Can you expound?
So in 1898, the U.S. was actually at war with Spain, and the Philippines has been a Spanish colony for hundreds of years. And so when the U.S. beat Spain, part of the, the way they settled the war out was, I believe, not in addition to the Philippines, but they also got Cuba and a couple of other places. But for the U.S. context, when we were a Commonwealth, they instituted public education, public healthcare, things like that. It's one of the reasons why the Philippines is one of the few countries out here in Asia that's basically 100% English speaking. I mean, and it's just crazy that, you have this random country in the middle of Asia that speaks so much English is one of the biggest things. And so after 1898 till about 1934, we were basically scheduled to get our independence, and then World War II happened. One of the reasons why the Philippines was so important, so a lot of people don't know, it's not just a naval base and not just an Air Force base. It was the world's largest Air Force base and the world's largest naval base.
What?
Yeah, because if you look at it strategically, Pearl Harbor cuts the Pacific Ocean in half. So strategically, you would have to go through Pearl Harbor before you actually attack the U.S., but if you look at the Philippines in relation to its position to China, to Japan, to Southeast Asia, to India, that is the perfect jump off point to have a military base, so that when you go from Pearl Harbor to the Philippines, it's the perfect place to launch warships and airplanes going into these Pacific theaters of war. So that's something that actually happened after we were given independence. I mean, those naval and U.S. bases did not close until like the 80s and 90s, actually, just recently.
And sex trafficking?
Yeah, well, because, around that time and this seems to be kind of a sore point with any particular military base that has a big presence in a foreign country, is the amount of trafficking or the amount of prostitution that occurs in that particular country to service, military people and things like that. Because the Air Force base is no longer there, the naval base is no longer there, the infrastructure is still there. So a lot of the Air Force and military installations were actually converted into hotels. And now it's actually just used to service, people from all over the world and those types of things. And so, as a college student, it was really crazy being able to be in these situations where, we were able to have these conversations with, prostitutes and interview them or interview mothers who, they call them Amerasians, forgotten children who, they're these beautiful children, but because of the way they look, ironically, they're ostracized because they're judged because they're known as, children of whores or something like that. You know, just coming into the plight of a lot of those children or even the children who grew up within the toxic waste contaminated areas where they had cerebral palsy, mothers with cancer and stuff like that.
And toxic waste, cerebral palsy, cancer?
Of the, just refuse left behind. You know, when you have the world's largest Air Force base leaving behind, jet fuel, I'm guessing, or whatever refuse is left behind, it could have a dramatic impact on the environment and those types of things. And so for us, one of the first things that we actually did after that program is we launched and started a nonprofit called Kamayat Puso, or Hand and Heart. And through Hand and Heart, it was a center that basically provided physical therapy for the children who were impacted by that toxic waste contamination. So in some cases, the children were able to walk again, or they were able to feed themselves for the first time. And then what we would do is teach the mothers how to make jewelry, and then we would sell that jewelry in the U.S. so that the funds that were created from selling the jewelry would actually be used to support the physical therapy center.
You know, Roland, I think of the famous phrase, war is hell, right? I think folks look at war and say, well, once it's over, hell is over. But it's not the case, right? So I was in Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam a few years ago, right? I went to the Agent Orange exhibit that profiled the thousands of Vietnamese folks who grew up and lived in the parts of the country in which the U.S. used Agent Orange. And man, it's just been devastating. It's devastated families to this day. I mean, people are born 2, 3, 4 generations later with birth defects. It's awful. I didn't realize, my ignorance, I suppose, that some of this was also in the Philippines as well.
Absolutely. And that was actually one of the saddest things about it. And it just really put things into perspective of, really when I say I wanted to really come back here and felt more at home, you come face to face with those types of situations. And it's just really character building experiences that really drive some of the point about what am I going to do with the rest of my life living on Earth? And, what kind of impact can I have, on the Philippines, and how positive can that be? And yeah, I mean, as a college student, that's just those types of experiences were like years of classes, I mean, you can't just take a class on that. You just have to experience that.
Amen. All right. So you finish up this life-changing semester. You said you actually felt more at home in the Philippines than you did in California. You get back to the States. What happened next?
So that one is, that's actually a really interesting thing. So, I was actually trying to think about my impact, and, I started to have some questions about, the effectiveness of, because coming from a student activist thing, and, at the time it was just like these more revolutionary type things. I thought the best way to change the government was through revolution and not through reform. And, so idealistic at the time.
You sure you went to Santa Barbara and not Berkeley?
Yeah, exactly. And, I was thinking about that. And there were points though that, coming, how do I say this? Some of the activists I was talking to, it just didn't feel like we were going to get anywhere with that type of kind of talk where we would actually occupy the Capitol and do these kind of things, because quite frankly, it's not like in the US. I mean, you'll just get killed, and people were getting killed. And I was like, okay, I don't know if that's actually the best way to do things. And I remember I read this book called Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid by C.K. Prahalad. And it was this whole concept of microfinance and microenterprise. And I started to discover this whole concept called social entrepreneurship. And it changed my whole life in terms of the way I was actually looking at impact and how through micro communities, I was reading about Grameen Bank and just this whole ability to have these savings groups and utilizing education as a way to do and uplift millions of people out of poverty. I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is exactly, it was fully aligned with how, because I was thinking about those mothers in the Philippines, like how would you help those mothers? Like, wow, microfinance, social entrepreneurship and things like that. And so while I was reading about those types of things, I started dabbling and trying to be an entrepreneur. At first, it was consumer finance related type things. You know, I had a job with General Electric and I was trying to learn about, you know, what it took to be a business person, but that didn't work out at all. And I basically just quit and had an opportunity to move to San Francisco to be an entrepreneur and start an internet marketing company.
As one does.
Yeah. You know what? It's not exactly social entrepreneurship, but there's something about the internet that was really forming the foundation of something that was going to change things. And when I went in that direction, I actually moved to San Francisco and tried to start a tech startup with some of my friends that I met from all around the country. And that was called Tracking 202.
Tracking 202. All right. How'd it go?
So while I was over there, just like anything, we were living in a house. I was living in the kitchen. We had an engineer in the garage, another engineer in the attic. And basically, we saw a problem of internet marketers who were... So this is before the word platform even existed.
Okay. So what year was that?
This is 2008, 2009, I think. And they weren't using that word. But for us, you know, we saw that internet marketers were utilizing spreadsheets and they would have to log into their Google account, their Yahoo account, their MySpace account. Gosh, this is so long ago. MySpace, Facebook. And they would take their ad spend and then they would take a spreadsheet. And as an internet marketer, especially if you're an affiliate, you would earn commissions for the amount of leads or sales that you would generate. And so you'd have to take another spreadsheet and then take a look at your sales there. So for us, we just created a software where we actually aggregated all that data into one screen or a platform, if you will. And this internet marketing software was very easy for a lot of internet marketers to use. Again, while I was doing that, I was helping Kamaya Puso and those types of things. So it was almost like I had this double life where I still had this kind of line of communication that was going on in the Philippines. I didn't really have that many resources at the time. So I was doing that. But then as an internet marketer, I felt like I was building the skill set to say, okay, cool. Maybe I could have the resources to be able to have an impact. Now, what ended up happening is we were running out of money, but because we integrated with Facebook, at the time, we were collecting so much data. It was so crazy that we actually got an offer to buy the company. This agency back in Southern California made an offer to buy us out. And so it was actually with that successful exit that I finally had the resources to actually go back to the Philippines and do full-time humanitarian work in the Philippines.
And this was what year? 2010. All right. So 2010, you've got a nice exit for yourself. You're in your what? Late 20s and you just pick up and head to the Philippines?
Exactly. So, okay. So this is actually kind of like a weird curveball. So I also consider myself a pretty spiritual person. And but during this whole time of moving to San Francisco and figuring out my purpose, I actually read this book called The Purpose-Driven Life. And it ended up being a book from a pastor who is more on the more conservative Christian types of things. And so, but the thing is, there was something about that title, Purpose-Driven Life. And I was reading it and I started going down this path of really discovering what it means to really fulfill my purpose and serving, for a higher cause. And at the time, I really got into this whole kind of spiritual awakening, where I did get plugged into a more conservative kind of way to serve. And I ended up doing missions where I would actually go to the Philippines and do missions around HIV AIDS, anti-sex trafficking work, poverty alleviation, and clean water initiatives for a good solid 2 or 3 years. And it was through that, I think that, you know, in retrospect, it was a huge fail because, you know, I ended up not being like this, like, quote unquote, pastor or anything like that. I actually ended up, for the lack of a better word, there was a lot of anxiety, and I was actually diagnosed with a certain level of depression because of certain things that just were misaligned with my own personal thing. Unfortunately, I'm not trying to say that they're not bad people. It's just that there was just certain politics that just didn't align, where I ended up losing everything that I had saved up. I ended up, you know, being in a relationship that ended, and, you know, quite, and also my health was really bad. And, but the cool part about surviving from darkness and turning the corner is you start realizing, wow, that was like the worst life can hit you. And when you really hold on to that single strand of hope that really pushes you above, you know, that really dark period, the certain level of confidence and the level of fearlessness that comes from getting out of a dark place really sets you up for a bigger thing. And so in a lot of ways, you know, without being too spiritual about it, it was an answer to my prayers, because throughout that whole entire period of me questioning whether I was doing the right thing, I was praying for wisdom. And gosh, losing everything and coming back out of that situation and finding a certain level of fearlessness and confidence was an answer to that prayer. And my gosh, I just got more wise about life surviving that whole time period in my life.
You know, Roland, just knowing how uber successful you are now, although we haven't gotten there yet in the story, it makes your experience all the more inspirational. Not to mention, man, these headlines of billion-dollar exits in startup world make us think that this whole journey we call life and entrepreneurship, it's rainbows and butterflies, but that ain't it, right? So I just want to say, man, thank you for opening up and for highlighting what can be the fragility and the importance of mental health. It's not easy. All right, I don't want to detract from that, but you know, you've got this less than easy experience in the Philippines. What'd you do from there?
I was able to just say, you know what, I'm just going to go back into something that I know, which was the internet marketing world. But instead of being an entrepreneur, I was a partner of a well-established firm. So, you know, more like a vice president of a company. So I went to just, I thought, you know what?
Let me guess, go make some more money and go back to the Philippines again?
This is the funniest thing. Never give up on that dream of the Philippines. Because at the time, I lost everything. So I didn't have the resources to go back to the Philippines. But what I was going to do is I was going to get a job and I was going to save up my resources and find a way to go back.
So this internet marketing VP role was the vehicle to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And so I found it. One of my friends, they owned an internet marketing company, and I joined it. And you know, I helped grow their business and I was able to save up. And while I was there, that's where I met Rexy, my co-founder, who re-inspired my whole dreams and visions of going back to the Philippines. I mean, here's a kid. He's 10 years younger than me. He founded this nonprofit while he was at Brown, and he was taking promising Filipino students from Harvard, from Stanford, from Georgetown, from Brown, from the University of London, from the University of Toronto, and he was putting them on these 2-month-long internships in the Philippines. And they would come back and say, you know what, I'm rejecting my job offer at Amazon and I'm starting an AI company in Manila. Or I'm not going to be an investment banker in New York. I'm going to help a family business in Manila. And I was like, wait, what? Your program reminds me of the life-changing program that I went through when I was in college. And I was like, I want to help you. And so while he was trying to get this nonprofit off the ground, I was helping him do that. And it was through the fact that I was an executive again and making decent money again, I was able to support him while doing this job. And, Yeah. And so that was really what kind of started setting up the foundation for what ended up being Kumu.
All right. So is it Rexy?
Yeah, Rexy.
Right. So Rexy has this incredibly impactful project that rings home for you and your involvement in helping Filipinos find meaningful work in the Philippines. It fulfills you whilst you simultaneously keep this marketing gig. And this is what, 2000 and?
That was 2000, literally the year after. So around 2015. This is so cool, by the way, to be able to watch, just running through memory lane here. So 2015, you know, I'm growing, I'm basically recovering things. I just, you know, during the stupider times when I exited, you know, I was driving, you know, like a Porsche, I was driving, you know, in these really fancy places. But this time out, I felt the hunger coming back. So I went full on living below your means mode. I was living in a super tiny studio in Santa Monica. Yeah, it was by the beach, but it was tiny. It was like people would laugh. They go, "Holy crap, my closet is bigger than your apartment, Roland." And it was, and you know, I gave my car at the time to my stepdad, and I was just like, just putting as much savings as I could into my savings account while helping Rexy.
Okay, so now you really were a non-broke minimalist.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're right. I was pretty much a minimalist. And that's exactly it. And it was funny because, you know, I was thinking about 4-hour work week where I hired an account manager, I hired a media buyer, and basically I was able to transfer a lot of my, I was able to optimize everything down to maybe 1 or 2 hours a day so that I could really start prepping and focusing for what I believed was going to be this next hurrah. And a lot of those discussions happened because Rexy and I would always talk about, you know, the power of the Filipino diaspora, basically the 12 million Filipinos around the world who are sending billions of dollars back home. And what is the most effective way that we could help out? Because through his work, we were sending the promising generation of Filipinos to the Philippines, exposing them to the Philippines and inspiring them or some of them to stay and actually build businesses there and things like that. Now, what ended up happening was, the work actually caught the attention of the Philippine ambassador to the US at the time. His name is Jose Quisha. And the Philippine ambassador, I had dinner with him in Koreatown. I remember we were eating, Korean barbecue and stuff like that. And he was telling me that, "Hey, Roland, you know, you have this long history and background and passion for the Philippines, but 100% of your time has really been in the nonprofit NGO space. You've been doing mission work, you've been doing clean water work, you're doing a nonprofit where you're sending people back home, which we love and appreciate. But, you know, professionally," he was telling me that with all the time that I've been doing in internet marketing and as an entrepreneur and in technology, he was making this argument that actually with digital transformation and all the job creation that's happening, not just in the Philippines, but also all over Southeast Asia, he's saying that, "What if I started a technology company in the Philippines and that maybe the technology jobs that I create in the country, that's maybe the best way that I could impact the nation?" And one of the reasons why that was a very fundamental kind of moment in my life, because it was merging two worlds into one. It was this whole narrative of wanting to give back to the Philippines. But then it also merged that pragmatic part of me of, you know, wanting to know more about the internet and technology and entrepreneurship, and just being able to do two things at once was something that just really shook me to my bones. That literally right after that dinner, I called Rexy and I said, "Rexy, I just had dinner with the Philippine ambassador. What are your thoughts?" And that's when he said, "You know what? Maybe now's the time for us to really think through not just, you know, his nonprofit, but thinking through ideas of what it would take to actually build a business in the Philippines." And so it was around 2016. Actually, no, sorry. So at that point, we were working together for a few years. So it was around 2017 where we started thinking through, you know, ideas on, you know, what would actually work in the Philippines.
All right. So you've set the stage for this one. Roland, what would work in the Philippines?
So we started researching consumer internet business. So one thing that came out of the research was this market opportunity of really prioritizing the local market. So we saw like WeChat in China or Kakao Corporation in Korea or Line Corporation in Japan. You know, then we started looking at emerging markets, Gojek building this $10 billion super app in Indonesia, and VNG Corporation building a multi-billion dollar app ecosystem, prioritizing the voices and the needs of Vietnamese. And we're like, okay, well, if VNG can do this in Vietnam, why not the Philippines? And so we started building this thesis around prioritizing the Filipino market through consumer internet that, you know, the first idea that came out was a messenger app in which ended up becoming a fail, but fundamentally was the foundation for Kumu. Actually, Kumu is actually short for Kumu Stab, which is how are you, which was the name of our messenger app that failed, but we pivoted. Yeah.
So what? The idea was just a localized version of a WhatsApp, a Viber, a Facebook, messenger app for the Philippines?
So that was exactly it. You know, we were looking and studying. So VNG had a messenger app called Zalo, and there was nothing different from Zalo and WhatsApp and that. But it was the fact that it was prioritizing Vietnamese voices and their ability to connect Vietnamese people all over the world because of this kind of hyper-local approach to it being Vietnamese. So we said, okay, cool. Why don't we launch a messenger app that really prioritizes the needs of Filipinos? And my gosh, because again, what we were talking about earlier, because the Philippines was so westernized and the Vietnamese wasn't, when we launched Kumu, the messenger app in February 2018, it was a total fail because the Philippines is so westernized that people just thought it was a stupid idea. And so I remember when we first announced it, already in the Facebook comments, it was like, 3 years too late. I don't get it. Gen Z's use Telegram. Everyone uses Viber. You know, Messenger is free, you know, stuff like that. And I think that's what's so important about like never giving up, because, you know, we never gave up on the vision of bringing Filipinos together. It's just that the product wasn't the right one. And so
you pivoted to live streaming.
Absolutely. And so live streaming was a feature that was in the background. It wasn't even a core part of the product. And something that we noticed where cohorts of users were like retaining hardcore on the live stream part. I mean, we were like picking up the phone, talking to our users, and we were just shocked by how many people loved the live streaming app and the communities that were forming around the live streaming part of the app and not so much the messenger. And when we started looking at past cases, 10 years prior, back in 2010, there was a team, they had a check-in messenger type app called Bourbon, and it's the same exact pivot. It was a check-in app, you know, had Messenger, but no one really cared. But there were communities forming around the photo sharing and photo editing part of that app that when they decided to pivot into photo sharing and photo editing app, that's when they rebranded themselves as Instagram. And that's when that blew up. And so we were thinking, okay, cool. So, well, now that it's 10 years later, and because billions of dollars are being spent on internet infrastructure in the Philippines, you have affordable smartphones because of Vivo, Oppo, Huawei, and Xiaomi. And then the market of Filipinos, you have 100 million Filipinos who are mostly Gen Z and millennial that...
Well, hold up, man. So in summary, you've got over 100 million Filipinos, a vast majority of whom are young and English speaking. You've got billions of dollars going into internet infrastructure and an influx of affordable smartphones flooding the market?
Yep.
My gosh, man, that sounds like a perfect storm.
That's exactly it. And so when you look at that perfect storm, people at the time in 2018 were very pessimistic about the Philippine internet. But for live streaming to actually work, according to our interviews with the users, you know, we only needed 1 megabyte upload, 1 megabyte download capabilities, which was what the Philippine internet was doing at the time. Now it's improved drastically over the last 3 years. And so that was what's so important about really leaving enough room for your community to define your product, because our community was telling us that the product was ready for live streaming before anyone else did. Because at the time, no entrepreneur was saying, I want to start a live streaming app in the Philippines, because that's even worse than launching a messenger app, you know? And I think that's what's so important about that pivot is, you know, you pick up the phone and you talk to your users, and they're clearly telling us that there's something magical about what's going on. And yeah.
All right. So let's get to the crux of it. I'm a creator on Kumu. I'm walking down the street to the grocery store. I can live stream. I'm at the gym. I can show everyone my deadlifts. I'm getting ready for sleep. I can show my followers my bedtime routine.
No. Yeah. So the magic really is, and then this is what's so relevant to today, and one of the reasons why we just grew so much, is that a content creator who's actually going live on Kumu, there's something real and raw and authentic about going live. You're not, you know, the Philippines is widely documented as one of the heaviest social media users in the world. All the social media apps are being used.
Yeah, I've read that. Why do you think that is?
You know, I still, there's still studies on it. I honestly still don't know. Maybe the familiar nature of Filipinos, maybe it is the westernized context. Maybe it is because we do have 12 million Filipinos around the world and there's a need for people to connect. There's just something about Filipinos just loving to be on the internet all the time. Could be because the traffic is so bad. Could be because there's so many different elements that are going on there. Because even prior to that, we were the texting capital of the world back when, you know, 3G, was the thing. But in the 4G LTE environment for a content creator, there's something real and raw and authentic. And so for a content creator who's on Instagram, there wasn't this social anxiety of pretending that your life was perfect. There wasn't this editing your content for YouTube. And because you're not hiding behind a keyboard, a lot of the toxic behaviors you see on Twitter and Facebook, you weren't seeing none of that. And that's what was coming out of our interviews with our content creators. They go, there's something about just the fact that you guys are 100% live that's real, raw, and authentic that I appreciate. So that's number one. But then on the viewer side, to your point, when you're watching the content, you're not recognizing the content with views. You're not recognizing the content with likes. You're recognizing the content. And if you like it, you send recognition in the form of a microtransaction or a virtual gift that you could actually convert into commissions. And that's very similar to something I remembered in Santa Monica, which was street performance or busking. You know, you're playing the guitar, you like the content, and you put a dollar bill in their guitar case. But we were doing that digitally 100,000 times every single day. And a lot of that growth happened because of that authentic connection. Well, that's what we called it, authentic connection. The aha moment of the viewer sending a microtransaction to a content creator who was creating content in a live environment. It was those two factors where we were able to grow. And from there, it just, gosh, when we made that pivot, that's when millions of people just started downloading the app.
Millions of downloads, man. And you guys went live when?
So August 2000. So February 2018 was the Messenger app. We made the decision to pivot 6 months after launch to a live streaming app in August 2018. And then it was around August 2018, we started launching some live stream shows very similar to like HQ. You remember HQ at the time?
Yeah, Trivia HQ, of course.
Yeah, those types of things. And yeah, very quickly, we became the number one trending social app in the country. But because of the revenue model, we became the first ever Filipino app to be the number one highest grossing social app. So the first time we hit that, yeah, so from August 2018, we were number one trending, but then number one grossing was 2019. And then it just really started to take off, yeah.
So the growth, it's obviously really impressive, but I got to ask, aside from this micro gifting component, what makes you more different from like Instagram Live?
Okay, so the core part of the app, you know, now people are like, okay, I don't see how it's any different than say the live stream that happens on TikTok or even say Twitch, which is a gaming version of what we do. The thing that really set us apart, and Rest of World actually calls us the Disneyland of social media because of it, is we unapologetically focused on our core values of safety, positivity, and acceptance. And we had no idea how important that stance was going to be. And people are now seeing it right now because of what's happening to Facebook, which is so weird. And back then, when we doubled down on those core values, it's because we were embracing this whole concept of social entertainment rather than social media or social network. Because very early, if you didn't have that content moderation in place and you didn't have those core values of safety, positivity, and acceptance, can you imagine what a live streaming for money platform would turn into?
OnlyFans.
It turns into like an OnlyFans. It turns into toxic crap. We don't allow politics on the platform. All sorts of different things. If you're too fake, we tell you to go to Instagram. If you're being too toxic, we tell you to go to Facebook. Like, there's something about that, that when we took this stance, it wasn't a technological differentiator. It was a cultural differentiator. There was something special about creating this culture around these three core values. And that's one of the reasons why we say social entertainment, why we're being compared to Disneyland. It's like, yeah, sure, there's the entertainment part of Disneyland, but it also allowed us to recognize and appreciate how strict the security force at Disneyland is. You know, if you go to Disneyland and you look dangerous in the parking lot, you won't even get in to the park. You know, you don't go to Disneyland to complain about the presidential administration. You go there to have fun. You go there to enjoy. You go there to escape real life. And so for us, we don't say that you're really escaping real life. You're just escaping the stresses and all that crap that goes on outside, especially like what's happening on Facebook and TikTok.
So in this Disneyland of sorts of social media, of content creation, who are your creators? Like the same stuff you'd see on TikTok?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. You know, yesterday we had one of the craziest, we actually had the most people on the app ever, right? Our servers were almost crashing again and stuff like that.
And how many users was that?
Well, it was concurrent. We had around almost 500,000 people, right? Just concurrently using the app in the day. And it just really pushed us to our limits. And, you know, I'm looking at the content and, you know, a lot of times when we do talk to our international investors and they try to see the difference between, say, like us and a TikTok, it's just like, look, the average daily user on Kumu is on Kumu for 63 minutes, which is a long time. But the thing is, our counterparts over at TikTok, it's around the same, right? 63 minutes. It's just that 63 minutes on TikTok, to your point, is hundreds of pieces of content. And when you're swiping through hundreds of pieces of content, it really pushes that company to push an advertising monetization model because of the amount of impressions that are going on. But for Kumu, 63 minutes means only two or three pieces of content because you're spending quality time with that person. And that all of our business, most of our business is based off the generosity of the community because it's literally like busking.
That's so interesting. And so what? You take a small slice of the gifts the creators get?
Yeah, that's exactly it. We take a small slice. And so right now we have about 1,500 live streamers who earn a full-time income on the app and about 10,000 live streamers who earn a part-time income on the app. And, you know, it takes several millions of those people to support them. And we take a small cut of that. And for the average live streamer who earns a full-time income, they need 15 supporters. And those 15 supporters, or to get to 15 supporters, you need maybe a couple hundred viewers. And then to get like a couple hundred viewers every time you live stream, you need a couple thousand fans. And what's so cool about that context is—
So to make full-time job-type revenue, you only need a couple thousand fans?
You only need a couple thousand fans. So you could just focus on being authentic, being yourself, be consistent, and build a big enough of a following to earn a full-time income. This isn't— to earn that much income on Spotify or YouTube, you need millions of views, millions of listens, millions of followers. And for us, it's because you're really capturing the attention span of this whole ethos of having like 100 people love you, not 1,000 people like you, because this is some authentic stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I mean the number one tenet or principle in fandom or audience creation 101 is you'd rather 100 super fans than 1,000 just normal fans. It's pretty cool to see that in action.
No, exactly. And, you know, for us, yeah, sure, there have been calls like, oh, maybe we should be racy, those things, whatever. But I think for us, that's what really holds us is like we've been, that's actually one of our kind of claims to fame in the global technology world is we actually made live streaming possible in a wholesome environment. You know, we're very, very confident that when you look at every other live streaming for money platform on the planet, none of them have as much, because like, for example, for us, you know, like yesterday, one of the reasons why, we had that spike in traffic is we're the first ever mobile app that has worked with a Big Brother franchise, you know, the reality TV show, and really brought that concept into the app where people are able to really interface with the people in the house. We have 24/7 live streams in the living room, in the kitchen, and things like that. And, you know, working with brands like McDonald's or things like that, like those types of brands would never work with a live streaming for money app that was utilizing, you know, quasi OnlyFans type of leanings, you know?
No, of course not. I can't see McDonald's saying link in bio with a wink, right? So back to your creators to get fandom. They're what? They're singing? They're playing the guitar?
Yeah. Singing is something that Filipinos just known globally for. There's a lot of singing. There's a lot of, so the word tambay in the Tagalog language, it just means hanging out. There's a lot of hanging out. There's a lot of games that are played. There's a lot of, I would say singing, hanging out, on the community commerce side has been super interesting. So community commerce, we don't call it e-commerce, we call it C-commerce. And the e-commerce streams are super important because it really differentiates us from Shopee or Lazada, which is basically like the Amazon of Southeast Asia. And it's like sports card collectors, Pokemon toy collectors, sneaker heads, really niche communities, cosplayers, anime, gamers. The way we do e-commerce really reflects our core focus on communities. And so we're really focused on communities. So beyond just the singing and the hanging out, and I think the number one thing is just really focusing on communities. Like the volleyball community is a huge community on the app where you have a lot of the most famous volleyball players. So in the Philippines, male basketball and female volleyball are like institutions. And so having the whole female volleyball community, from all the top professional players to all the top collegiate players, they're all going live, hanging out with each other, spending quality time, those types of things.
All right. So I'm a basketball player. I just start streaming my free throw practice. I've got my community watching. How do I monetize that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of key things. You know, a lot of it is, building the core experience around recognizing people, right? So for example, if you're going live and you drop a virtual gift, that person will do like a shout out, and if you will, almost kind of like a cameo, if you will. You're like, oh, thank you so much for the gift. But a lot of times, and this is something that we're building from the feedback that we got from our convention in Vegas, is really creating more opportunities to give back. So for example, one of the live streams that I just saw yesterday was people were raising funds to support jeepney drivers. So jeepney drivers is like a form of public transportation in the Philippines. And I saw that like people were just live streaming to raise funds for jeepney drivers. Another thing was one of the most coolest things we've ever done is we actually financed a film that got into the prestigious Metro Manila Film Festival. And the director of the movie is the highest grossing box office director of all time in the Philippines, was the director of that movie. And it was so crazy because she fell in love with Kumu because, you know, just during the pandemic, she just really liked the authenticity. She was allowed to be herself. And we created these contests. All right, whoever gets the most virtual gifts in the next 2 weeks will be one of the co-stars in the film.
Wow.
Or whoever gets the most virtual gifts this week will be in the background. Whoever gets the most virtual gifts, your song will be submitted as part of the soundtrack. And when we collected all those virtual gifts across all the different campaigns we did, it was actually enough to finance the film. And then for it to be filmed, so this December in the Metro Manila Film Festival, that movie is going to be but in every single, movie theater in the country. And we're already talking to, I can't share, but let's just say one of the big OTT platforms like a Netflix is, we're in talks of them picking it up. It's like the funniest thing. It's the funniest thing. And, you know, we're seeing more and more of those types of opportunities where, you know, again, it's more purpose driven type of live streaming. So it's like, whether it's for a cause, whether it's for raising funds to be in a film or, you know, or recognition, a lot of times it's just really around that.
So with all these use cases, Roland, and revenue streams, let's talk numbers. Where are we?
Yeah, I mean, it's getting there. So let's see here. So the numbers I can share. So for sure, we're definitely well over 10 million registered users. 3 million of them are active monthly. On the revenue side, I don't know if I could share the numbers, but what I could say is we're the first ever Filipino app to be the number one highest grossing social app in the Philippines. Facebook number two. And what's really interesting, though, is because of the global nature of Filipinos, the first Filipino app to be the number four highest grossing social app in Canada, number five in Australia, number six in Hong Kong, seven in Singapore, eight in Norway. I didn't realize we had that many Filipinos there. Top 10 in multiple markets in the MENA region. And, you know, and something that's really interesting, too, coming back from the convention is the amount of non-Filipino fans of Filipino culture. I wouldn't say like as big as say like K-pop, but maybe a more urban kind of niche version of like the internationalization of K-pop, where people are really feeling, you know, Filipino culture, especially the way that we're doing it, which is a safe, positive and accepting way of building communities. So yeah, so numbers, that's where we're at. The average daily users around 63 minutes. They watch about 60 million live streams, every single month. You know, we just raised, well, that's public, Series C. So General Atlantic made their first ever investment in the Philippines. And it was us, which brought our collective fundraising to over $100 million. And it was actually with their support, they've been really stretching us. You know, their previous three social apps they invested in were, you know, ByteDance, or the developer TikTok, Snapchat, and Facebook prior. And their ability to recognize businesses and help them become IPO-able has been something that's really high on our desire list, because we feel like it's our responsibility. Rexy and I, ever since the days that we were talking about this as an idea 3.5 years ago, is what is the best way that we can give back to the Philippines? And whether it's the thousands of live streamers who could potentially earn a full-time income on the app, or being the number one consumer internet company in the Philippines, so that adjacently we could impact music, we could impact e-commerce, we could impact experiential retail. You know, there's a lot of different things that we want to do in the long term, because something from a numbers perspective is we look at the top public market companies in the US in 2009, conglomerates, oil companies, retailers like Walmart. 10 years later, it's Apple, Alphabet, Facebook, whatever. And so we see the same thing in the Philippines. The top market cap company in the Philippines are all conglomerates, telcos, things like that. And if we can just be one of the top five companies in the Philippines in the next, say, 10 years, then it really puts us in a position to have a lot of impact, where it's hundreds of thousands of people, you know? But yeah.
Dude, I mean, you look at General Atlantic on your cap table, the macro tailwinds you have, your understanding of your customer base, your TAM, your product, and you, Roland. Am I talking to the future first Filipino unicorn?
So technically, there was one that just recently got it, but it was like a conglomerate-backed one. So there was a conglomerate that put hundreds of millions of dollars into a fintech app that just hit a $2 billion valuation. And there's a lot of conversation that they don't count or something like that. And, you know, I get it, you know, for a lot of my peers who say that's not fair. For me, though, they also received the first ever investment from companies like, you know, KKR and some other businesses. I mean, to for a startup to receive $300 million investment on top of the $100 that we got, you know, the Philippine market is turning a corner. And to answer your question, yeah, I think for us, you know, we're definitely on our way to getting there. And I think that the more important thing for Kumu is to just focus on solving those huge problems, whether it is about bringing people together, whether it is about optimizing internet connectivity and providing value to an entire generation of Filipinos that I guess the assumption is for sure. And something that General Atlantic always reminds us of is they don't invest in unicorns, they invest in decacorns. So I think for us, we just, you know, we do have the right partners to continue to push our vision and to keep us grounded as we stay focused.
So what's the roadmap? Add other features, roll out in other markets, spend on marketing, all the above?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at Kakao Corporation and what they were able to do in Korea, it was not just Kakao, the messenger app. I mean, dude, when they went adjacent and launched a taxi service, they beat Uber within 1.5 years. I'm not saying we're going to launch an Uber, but I think that whole concept of launching adjacent businesses that provide value for an entire market is definitely one roadmap. And that's something that we've been thought through. Now, something that's also interesting, and this is something that we'll have to really answer in the next 12 to 18 months, is that Netflix has talked to us and said, look, the Philippine market is super interesting to us. It's 100 million English speakers. When something hits in the US, in the Philippines, we know it's going to work globally. You know, we've seen that with Money Heist. They've seen that with Squid Games. There's all sorts of different pieces of content where they're like, this is going to hit. Same thing with our conversation with Spotify. There's something about the English-speaking market that when Taylor Swift sees that it does well in the Philippines, there's a lot of confidence that it's going to do well globally.
A content guinea pig of sorts, no? It's interesting.
Facebook knows. I mean, we talk about it all the time, social media capital of the world. But I don't know if a lot of people don't know this, but Cambridge Analytica tested the Philippine market and impacted the Philippine elections before it went over and impacted the 2016 election.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you guys Google it, like a lot of Cambridge Analytica's initial work on utilizing those quizzes to understand and profile people helped result in the previous election that occurred with us, which also impacted the election. So there's something about the 100 million English-speaking people in an emerging market. Call it a very cheap and affordable way to test things that could work globally. And the implication about that is we built an app that's actually going toe-to-toe with every social app in the world, whether it's TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. And so I guess what people are saying is that similar to, okay, so look at this. General Atlantic invested in Byju's, an edtech platform that took off in India and is now the world's most valuable edtech platform. They invested in C, the owners of Shopee and Garena, and they are now at a $200 billion market cap with huge growth in Latin America, not just in Southeast Asia, but in Latin America. And then third, when they invested in ByteDance, they were focusing on this Chinese short form video app that ended up rebranding as TikTok and marched across the world. And so they have this thesis that like, look, you have innovation happening on the other side of the world that's having global impact. So, you know, there is some implication that just maybe what we're building here could have global impact. And again, we're going to have to, we'll solve. I mean, I'm not saying we're going to do that, but in the next 12 to 18 months, we're going to answer that question.
You know, I think when people look at emerging and frontier market venture, they assume the lowest hanging fruit is just a copy paste of what's worked in the West, right? Like bringing together the Uber of Southeast Asia, the Robin Hood of sub-Saharan Africa. But Roland, with what you're building in the Philippines, it's as if it's your product that could be copied and pasted in the more developed markets itself.
Yeah, you know, that's, you know, and that's an interesting thing because number one thing I want to share is I see myself as a steward of the business. So the thing is, I just want to help, you know, there might be like a CEO who's actually better built for the global march, you know, call it like the way some people became chairman and found the CEO, right? I think where my role is to really be that steward and just make sure that we are properly positioned for that. Because to your point, it's just so crazy. Like when Byju's announced, you know, this Indian edtech platform that they're going to spend $1 billion into their expansion into the US, or the biggest one right now, TikTok. It's just like when they invested in TikTok, it just marched across the world. And so I think for us, you know, whether we do it or not, I think that I just want to make sure that the core values are in place because the biggest challenge that's going to impact us as we scale is can we stick to our core values of safety, positivity, and acceptance in a global world? And I would rather have a platform at 100 million people with 10x engagement with those core values than having a platform with billions of users and losing its soul.
Not something you hear every day from a tech founder. In social, no less. Raising hundreds of millions of dollars. Roland, man, you are an inspiration. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And also, too, it's just so lucky to have folks like Rexy. And a lot of people don't know is that, you know, three of the co-founders were just people I've known for over 20 years because that's just how I roll. I have never burnt a bridge and I've just been really lucky with continuing to maintain close, deep and interpersonal relationships with a small inner circle, you know?
A focus on a small inner circle from a dude running a social media platform with over 10 million users. Love it. That was Roland Ross from Kumu, not from Silicon Valley, but from the Philippines. New episodes of the podcast are released every other week, so be sure to subscribe to, share, and rate review Not From Silicon Valley on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again. We'll see you soon.